This podcast was brought to you by the For-Profit Art Council.
Yeah, so anytime you need a break, just call time out. Or if you need to use the loo.
Yeah.
The loo.
I wonder how people did that.
We just call it taking a shit, man.
Yeah, or taking a piss.
Yeah, taking a shit. That's a good one.
Yeah.
Yes. In corporate America, it's like, does anyone need a bio break? Do we need a bio break, anyone? Let's take five for a bio break.
Oh, God.
All aboard!
We were slumming, you know, in a sort of middle-class way. But it was the first time that we were actually, like, you know, in a boat. There's not much separating you from outside. And I've always, you know, I spent a lot of time outside. But I think it was when it really started to kind of hit home about being out there in nature, being part of nature, in a big 20-ton boat that runs on diesel. You know, like lots of podcasts, it's just like, let me educate you. But you were like, hey, we don't know what's going on. Get in touch. There's humility there.
On planet Earth, at the peak of human ingenuity, we still haven't managed to save ourselves from... Two brave souls have decided to take on our enemy to prevent the world from falling into the
Maximum
Motherfuckers fear the climate change. Let motherfuckers fear the climate change.
Hi, I'm JP Hurst.
And I'm Casey Snow.
And today we're going to dig a little deeper into the
Maximum Carbon Sinkhole.
On today's episode of The Sinkhole, we have a special guest from the UK. Say hello.
Hi, JA from the UK.
JA wrote us, as you can do, carbonsinkhole@protonmail.com. And JA is the official UK correspondent. It's that easy.
Oh, you have no idea what we made him do.
Yeah, there was an initiation. He had to send us pictures of his dooryard. Okay. We had this weird idea that we're like, we could create a sense of community, you know? And it turns out it wasn't that weird, right?
Yeah.
Because, you know, just like you, like we're struggling with just debilitating eco grief. We wanted to talk to JA today about his adaptation story.
It's kind of weird because you don't have those conversations with anyone. You try and bring up with your family or people you know, and it's shut down. You know, like people say, like, start saying something, find some little way of kind of, you know, getting your foot in the door, and they go, but people just don't care. And what that actually means is, I just don't care.
Do you feel isolated from your over-civilized friends and family? I guess we're sort of wondering if it's just us. Like if you already feel like you've made the turn, you know, both mentally and physically and maybe even geographically, where you just see all the cracks. Like it's so isolating because it's just like you said, you can't have these conversations. Like how do you end up dealing with those people in your life who don't care or think it's too dark to even broach the subject?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think sometimes it's a combination of two. Like, you just think, like, why aren't people freaking out? Why aren't people in the streets? You know, one good example is my mother. She thinks we're vegans because it's healthy. Because I think in some ways, it's easier for her to think that than to think any other reason why you might be a vegan, because it involves a sort of challenge to the way you've lived your life.
Yeah, that's really poignant, which is what's hard for me is when you're out with people that you know and you try to talk about something and they just kind of shut down and it's like, this is the problem. Nobody can deal with this. And how do we find a way to deal with this? Because we can't fix it if we can't even face it, you know?
You've covered so much ground in your podcast, but you've hit so many nails on the head. And I can't remember which one of you said it, but you said, you know, we know the answers, we know the solutions, but there's just no way of sort of getting there, is there? There's no way of implementing it. You know, the science is done, the things you can do, but here we are, you know, we're adapting. It's like an open-ended conversation, isn't it? I mean,
oh, for sure.
You know.
Yeah, yeah.
You heard us in the last episode of the podcast talk about dropping out as adaptation. And so one of the features that we want to have recurring from here on out is your story. Stories from you. You hear us say this all the time. How are you doing it?
Yeah, because I'm sure plenty of people are doing it better or different or have more interesting ideas, and we can all share it and figure out how to get the fuck out of this machine as much as possible. And
so, J.A., tell us a little bit about where you are in the world and kind of what you're up to there.
We live in Cambridgeshire, or Cambridgeshire, if you like, which is in the east of England. So for your non-UK listeners, it's kind of like a big booty sticking out on the east side.
A booty, like a butt?
Like a booty.
Yeah. I didn't know how else to describe it. I mean, no. It used to be like a kangaroo with a pouch, but I don't know.
I guess it does kind of look like a kangaroo with a pouch.
I have no idea.
Yeah, sometimes I'd say that to someone and they just look at me.
So you live in the booty of the UK. We live in the penis of America.
Yeah, but it's covered in sores.
Cool. So welcome to the sinkhole, J.A. Thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure, man. I mean, I just wanted to thank you on behalf of everyone who's listening, because it's a brave thing to do.
Well, we're really just scared. That's why we grab microphones, because we're freaking the fuck out, man. So it definitely doesn't feel like bravery. We're just like, we just need to have this conversation with more people as fast as possible so we can avoid the existential crisis that occurs from, as you said it, wondering why everyone else isn't freaking the fuck out.
Yeah, man.
So, J.A., when did you start freaking the fuck out? When did you figure out that the whole story about our great human civilization was wrong?
Yeah. I think you sort of, you know, in your last episode, you covered a lot of ground. And I think there isn't a kind of, well, you know, for me, there's no eureka moment where it's like, you know, just suddenly hits you. It's more just a kind of gradual process of, you know, growing up, if you like, you know, you start going through your adult life and just like, why is it like that? You know, but the climate change thing, I suppose it's always been there. I mean, I remember they used to call it here, I don't know if they called it that in the States, they used to call it the greenhouse effect when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. And it just sounded so quaint, you know, it's like, oh. You know,
yeah, greenhouses are pretty sweet.
We can grow orchids in
there. It's a nice metaphor, you know. Or tomatoes here. So it's always been there, but, you know, it's just like a snowball, isn't it? To go back to your question. I went to art school. You know, a lot of people would say, you know, you already dropped out. I mean, the art school I went to in my hometown, which is Norwich, which is also on the booty of the UK.
Oh, nice. You just love the booty, don't you?
Yeah, you know, it's all going on in that booty. But yeah, there is a small provincial art school, and there's actually many independent art schools outside of London. So it's like, yeah, it's a good place to go. You know, when you're at school, and they don't have a careers officer anymore, do they? But the careers officer say, oh, so you like drawing and painting. Maybe you should be a graphic designer. That's not drawing and painting. That's not being an artist, is it? That's just fitting into a job that already exists. I think me and CJ, my wife, were talking about this last night, because she also went to art school in a different way. I was fine art.
And she was rough art? Sorry, go ahead.
I've never had a career path, nothing, you know, not intentionally.
So have you been able to make a living and avoid the machine strictly as artists?
No, not at all.
well, let me just say, I'm fascinated by you two being artists, especially because, like, if there's one thing that I I always felt was that art was the one thing that was supposed to rally against the machine, and I don't think it does that anymore.
For real. They had a great provincial art school, but they had some like cool librarians there, and they used to stock magazines and pamphlets, and Adbusters was there. So, oh, you know, yeah. I was already like 18, and I was just sitting there reading Adbusters, you know.
Right.
Yeah, I remember that phase too.
It. You know, I'm into this. You know, I wasn't angry or rallying against anything, but I thought, you know, this is more my kind of thing.
Right.
Taking a, you know, that's what they want to teach you at art school is critical thinking, because they don't really teach you anything else.
That is a good point. I've never heard anyone make that argument before, but I would totally agree with you that even at a mediocre art school, you have to defend your thought process.
Right.
Yeah, but let me tell you, that art school now is the University of the Arts, and they do computer game design. And,
oh, no way.
Yeah, and hot desking, and, you know, it's not an art school. It's just a sort of corporate venture. It's becoming a sort of finishing school for polite people who are well-connected. A certain point in the last 15 years, the government raised the tuition fees, you know, to, I don't know, it's a lot. Anyway, it's like getting on for £10,000 a year. I paid a few hundred or something.
Oh, wow.
And a lot of money. So, yeah. So, there was, yeah, good times. But then, when I was in the first year, the people in the third year didn't pay anything. They got grants.
You know, oh, wow.
It happened very quickly. It's wow. become very privatized, like every other area of life, isn't it? It's just capitalism's got to have somewhere to go.
You guys lived on a boat for a while, is that right?
Yeah, that was a good dropping out moment. I suppose, to cut a long story short, finished art school, moved to London, cutting it as an artist, you know, doing lots of other jobs, part-time jobs so you can keep the art going. You're already learning to live with less, because not only have you got to live, you know, fucking expensive city like London, you've also got to pay for studio, you know, if you want a studio. So
oh, right,
you're already
yeah.
paying above the odds, working part-time. I used to really respect those guys who they would just eat tins of baked beans and they were just pursuing their art. But I could never do that, man.
Right.
I pursued the art, but I always had to have a safety net.
Seems like dropping out in a way is always a little bit selfish, because it's because you want to do something other than be a capitalist. And sometimes that means, well, you know what? I don't really care that much what kind of food I eat, as long as it's cheap and I don't starve to death, because I really want to do this other thing. And when you have that kind of experience, it seems almost silly to do all the other capitalist things.
Yeah, and it's in some ways, even just by doing something that is not a commercial pursuit, you're already in an unconscious way, you know, just following your passion or your interest. You're already doing what we talk about capitalism, like it's a thing. It's got a will of its own.
It does.
You're already doing something that capitalism doesn't want you to do, which is contribute to GDP. Like you, I'd say about it, between us, every decision that we've made, I'd say 90% of those decisions are selfish. You know, so you start to kind of, in hindsight, think, oh, yeah, maybe it was this kind of slow process of just getting out. So it was just, you know, like this can't go on, you know, like, we want to spend more time together, want to still be married, you know. So,
no kidding.
It was just like, fuck it, let's just buy a boat. And it was all CJ. Yeah.
That's awesome.
I was so reluctant. And the day we moved on the boat, I was just in such a terrible mood. You know. But we did it, you know, we did it. And yeah, so it was a real kind of full stop in a way, which... You don't get many of those, do you? I mean, it's just, you know, when do you ever just stop?
So where was this boat moored? What part of the sinkhole were you floating on?
Again, it was in a sort of least dropping out way possible. We were in a marina in a town, you know, we were plugged into the electrics. We weren't, you know, roaming free, you know.
There's people in Florida near us that live on boats that are rotting in somebody's backyard.
Yeah.
So that's why we were curious, like, how does living on a boat work?
Yeah. Yeah.
We didn't know anything about boats. But actually, I should say, it was a big boat. It was probably, the square feet was probably a similar size to our apartment in London. So it was like a sort of big floating one bedroom apartment plugged into the electrics. You know, we weren't, you know, we even had a little heater, you know, with radiators and, you know.
Oh, wow.
It wasn't like hard work. But it was, you know, it's like modern luxuries. You know, there's, you know, some of the people, you see other people on boats, and we were doing it out of choice. Other people, it's not a choice.
Right, right. That's a big difference. Yeah, yeah.
We were slumming it, you know, in a sort of middle class way. But it was the first time that we were actually like, you know, in a boat. There's not much separating you from outside. So that was the first kind of point for me. I think CJ is a big animal lover, nature person. And I've always, you know, I spent a lot of time outside, but I think it was when it really started to kind of hit home about being out there in nature, being part of nature in a big 20-ton boat that runs on diesel. But, you know, there's like swans and all kinds of, you know, there's a kingfisher that used to, you have kingfishers?
Yeah, yeah, kingfishers.
Oh, I did that. Birds,
they're so cool, right. Yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, they're the most beautiful birds in flight. And we, you know, we used to have longer tours pretty regularly and just things like that. And you know, you just sort of think, this is pretty cool.
It kind of hooks you too, because it's like you almost need more once you're exposed to that natural world in a really raw way. It's like, wow, something about it just feels good, you know?
Yeah, I think, I mean, a lot of people, you could say it's just escapism, but I think it's, you know, it's connecting as well, isn't it? I mean, it feels like a natural thing to do. And I suppose, you know, like we found a couple of kittens in a shed on a field, like you do. So they moved on the boat with us. So at that point, I mean, we were about 2 years in, and we were like, we can't really live on here with a couple of cats. So, yeah, then we left the boat and moved into a very small house in a village. And then we've been there for 2.5 years. And I think so, in some ways, it was the boat was the gateway drug. And now we're like, you know, out there digging the sunsets, you know, the last little bits of nature that haven't been destroyed by industrial agriculture.
Right. You know. Until they spray the sulfur to block out the sun, and then we won't even be able to enjoy the fucking sunsets.
Yeah. Assholes. Are you guys able to ride out climate shitstorms in your area? With your setup right now?
Yeah, I mean, our houses are made out of brick here. So I guess, you know, it's been there long enough. You know, it's been there 100+ years. But no one's ready. I mean, you know, what happens now is the summers are drier and hotter and the winters are wetter. So it's like the worst of all worlds in a way, because the water's got nowhere to go in the winter.
Right.
I mean, it's clay soil here, so it just, you know, it's just like a bog. I think if you're in America, it's maybe quite hard to, if you're inclined, or even if you're not inclined, for it to, any of that stuff to actually get to you. You know, like that guy said, it's a ratings killer.
Oh yeah, Chris Hayes, fucking weasel. You know, and he's quote like a progressive newscaster. Here in the States, one shift that's happened recently is there's still like the shit bags that go on cable news and you know, do the denial thing, although it's happening less and less. But the new line is, well, yeah, it's happening, we can measure it, but we can't do anything about it. So why should we fuck up our economy if China is just going to keep, you know, emitting, and India is just going to keep emitting? Like, why should we take the hit?
The cliches are so well, you know, trodden, aren't they? It's, you know, big car, big house, lawn. That's the American dream, isn't it? You know, that is, you know, big. Everyone's like, everything's big in America. The bread's sweet. You know, like that is the kind of...
fucking bread. They've got sweet. They eat biscuits.
That's because they put lard and sugar in everything here.
Hello, kids. I'm Wyatt Derpa, and I'm here to teach you about the UK. Do you know what the U.K. stands for? Uncool.
Cool isn't spelled with a K.
Well, kid, I don't want to embarrass you in front of your friends, but this here pack of cigarettes says something different. Anyway, the uncool over there across the ocean got their asses handed to them by my great-great-great-great-great-great-great second cousin Darren Von Derpa, nearly by himself. Those wig-wearing, pantyhose-strutting, tea-drinking commies thought they ruled this here free land, but they ain't never earned a dime in this here great America, so we killed them fuckers. Not all of them, of course. See, some hit over there, too scared to fight the United States of America, land of the free, and wheat, and corn, and guns, of course. Another interesting fact, kids, did you know they don't even know how to take a shit over there? True goddamn fucking story, kids. They go to the loo. Doesn't that just make you want to kick their asses?
Do British people?
Sorry, kids, the uncools over there. Those dear British are descendants of the chicken shits that weren't man enough to fight us badass Americans back in the day of my homie Darren. Anyway, go on.
Do the uncool still have sunsets?
Son, they ain't never had sunlight over there. Didn't even miss it. Them uncools, just like you, for them, sunlight only ever been a myth. Who taught you about the sun, anyway? Sunrises and sunsets, they ain't been part of the history curriculum no more. You got deviant folks there at home, son, filling your ears with poison?
Can I have a cigarette?
Of course, kid. This is fucking America. Cigarettes now keep the cancer away. Back in my day, they tried to ban these fuckers. Can you believe how stupid people were? All right, kids, hide behind the Kevlar wall. Looks like God sent in another shooter. This fucker definitely uses the loo. Now, return fire like you learned in art class.
You mentioned the American dream. Is there an equivalent UK dream that people are still clinging to? I mean, you know,
because we're so fucking cynical.
I love it.
Oh, I like it. Yeah, it's awesome.
UK dream is, let's hope it will be nearly as good as it was for our parents. But, you know, like, there doesn't seem to be much optimism, you know, like, there's no vision, you know, there's no grand sort of do this, this, and this, and, you know, your life will be great. It's just, well, there's no jobs, you know.
Yeah, shit kind of sucks.
For a bit of austerity, you know, no one can buy a house. Yeah, I mean, the dream of people, even people who are 10 years younger than me, I'm 37, they've got no hope of ever earning a house.
Right. You
know? So what is the dream? The dream now is go on fucking Instagram, go to some bitching places around the world, and just don't worry about, you know, just live for now. And unfortunately, that mentality is pretty lousy for anything ecological.
Yeah, no kidding. It's just like that fire tornado Instagram guy in Malibu that we mentioned on a previous he had the luxury Instagram travel lifestyle and was like, oh shit, there's a fire tornado in my backyard. It's like, maybe these things are fucking related.
But it's a hard sell. I mean, I can't turn around to people, you know, 20 years younger than me and say, you can't go to India, you know.
Right.
Yeah, why can't I do that? You did that. It's a really difficult one. And those things are getting more out of reach, the more people are going to do it while they can. And also, I'd just like to say, anyone listening in the UK, I've got a different interpretation of the UK dream. Please get in touch.
I read this the other day that we are the generation between stories. Does that sound... It sounded right to us. What about you?
Yeah.
I think this is what me and CJ talk about is... It's probably the same for you, I sort of intuited from the show, but it's like you've got one foot in that, you know, like, you know, you can buy a house, you know, you can do this, you can, we're still well in that, and you know, we can't go and live in a hut in the woods, you know.
Right.
It's not, we're still very much, you know, tied to the story.
Right.
Yeah. It's a, you know, it's a powerful story, but I suppose it's becoming less available as you know, generations pass.
And what about future generations? I mean, I like the idea that there's a parallel story, and we're of the generation that's got one foot in the story that's totally fucking crumbled. Like, the myth has shown to be complete hokum, and we know that, except that, you know, we came through the machine and we scraped out what we could, but we're also gonna still be alive for
and you know, we can expect to live a long life as well, so
right although we'll be the last. That's a good point.
But yeah, I mean, I think more and more it's like the emperor's new clothes, isn't it? You know, everyone knows it, but no one's saying it.
Right. I think the bigger thing is not a lot of people want to be the one that writes the new story. It's like, there's just a lot of people are very much followers, you know, and not in a bad way, just in that's who they are. And it's hard for them to reimagine something. And it's not because they're dumb. It's just their brains work differently or something. And it's like, but then, you know, all the people that do want to find this new story, that's, you know, this is why we're out there, is we need to figure out that new story and how to kind of spread it somehow.
Yeah. And speaking of the new story, I think all of us here have been inspired by the writings of Paul Kingsnorth. We happened upon his book, Confessions of a Recovering Environmentalist, by accident. How did you find his works? Are there more works like that in the UK?
It's just one of those names. It's always, you know, it's always there. We're not radicals, you know. We're not, you know, we look like, you know, pretty normal people. I might send you a picture so you could corroborate, but, you know, we, you know, like in the last, you know, maybe since our sort of dropping out incident, we've been on a path that is, you know, we're drifting away from sort of normal. And so, like, people like Paul Kingsnorth, they just sort of appeared in our lives, but he's, you know, he's always writing articles. And
Banksy has been exported and held up as anti-capitalist
Banksy,
hero.
Like, yeah, if you've been to art school, Banksy's a bit like, you know, like, I like the thing he did recently with the painting that shredded itself in the auction house. That was, yeah. You know. But, you know, I mean, I think it's a bit kind of page one.
Yeah.
You know, they're visual puns.
Visual puns. I love it.
You know, like the tranchant analysis or provocation isn't quite there. But, yeah, I don't know. It's like all these things. Like, Banks is quite cool until someone, like, pricks it for you. And then you're like, oh, yeah.
back on your adaptation story, J.A.
Yeah.
We have shared our love of gardening together. We've talked about that quite a bit.
Yeah. And that's, you know, that's been a bit of a kind of, you know, something that's really snowballed for us. You know, we had some, we had one of the better looking boats at the marina. You know,
some nice.
And, you know, that was, you know, we had some Wellington boots with some flowers growing out of them. You know,
it was
a nice little kind of, our first little, because it was, to a certain extent, you're kind of like, both of us, like, we've never even kept a houseplant alive.
Right.
You know.
Right.
So there's a real, you know, there's a real trepidation and a real sense that, like, people who are green fingered are, you know,
yeah.
I'm not green fingered. I'm just, you know, I just can't do that. But so, yeah, but since we've been in our house, it's got a small garden, but there's sort of some, we've left a lot of the things that were already there in, because it was a nice little kind of cottagey garden. And so, yeah, we just sort of set out trying to turn it into a sort of nature garden. And that was CJ's thing. And I was just like, you know, I've got a spade. I'm not interested in anything that doesn't, growing anything you can't eat. That's what I used to say. Yeah, so I would grow the vegetables. We've been growing vegetables for about, 4 years now.
Oh, so wow.
We, you know, yeah, okay. But this was the worst year. This was the hard truth year. I think we.
Oh, really? What happened? Was it weather related or anything like that?
Yeah, it was weather. It was timings. I think this is, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, the concept of the dooryard.
Right.
Is the place where you notice things. And, you know, I don't know if it's always been like this, but the timings of sowings and plantings are very difficult because we have very pronounced seasons in the UK. So, you know, spring is the time for planting. And if spring is cold and wet, forget it.
Right.
It's, you know, so hard, you know, to kind of get it right. And then it went from being a cold, wet spring to being an incredibly hot summer in a very short space of time. So, yeah, it was a hard truth year. But, you know, you just keep going.
How did gardening, you know, become part of your, you know, adaptation practice? I mean, like, for instance, like Casey and I, we definitely did not grow up gardening, but it's felt like, you know, gardening now feels like raging against the machine. It feels like a protective act.
Oh, totally. Yeah. I mean, my dad always says it's, you know, it's like therapy for him. So I think I always had that in the back of my head. There's a real kind of humility, you know, that's the word hummus as well, isn't it? Which is soil. You know, they'll come from the same root word. Yeah, it's all connecting. And I suppose the thing I didn't say, obviously I have no authority on no-dig gardening, but it's about not disturbing the network of, what would you say, critters?
Yeah.
And things that live in the soil. And so little is known about what lives in the soil. It's one of the least pursued areas of biology. So yeah, it's keeping that intact. So, you know, you're not, you know, fucking up a worm's house, you know, and they do the work for you. You know, the worms aerate the soil. I heard somewhere that an earthworm turns 6 tons of soil a month or something. That sounds pretty insane.
Well, worms, as we've discussed before, worms are the master race.
Yeah. Yeah. Because if only we could be like worms.
Yeah. Because they can
adapt
their society to the carrying capacity of their environment. That's a skill we don't have.
And also, you know, they're a good kind of canary in the coal mine, as it were. Like, no worms.
You know, right. Doing something
pretty. Speaking of other canaries, do you have a favorite butterfly?
Man, I'm terrible. I did a butterfly camp. other summer.
Wow, that's cool.
Yeah, it was just spend 15 minutes in your dooryard, see what butterflies show up, and you just sort of filled it on there. Some organizations, they were doing a sort of nationwide survey. Yeah, and I did that, but I can't remember a single name of them, but they're a really nice small one with it's kind of bluish, and it has a spot on each wing, but man, I don't know the names of these.
So in addition to gardening, how else are you coping with and fighting back against our collective eco-grief?
Sometimes it's quite hard to differentiate leading a sort of eco-led life and not doing capitalism. It's almost like they are so intertwined. So, yeah, I think reducing consumption. I mean, you know, we're not radicals. You know, we've got two cars, one of which isn't a hybrid, but it is 20 years old, you know. So, you know, not consuming. We're not getting a new car every year, which people do now. That's a thing.
So I know that you work with your hands.
So, yeah, I mean, just to kind of make it clear to anyone listening that the art doesn't pay the way. I've had some really nice jobs, but we moved out here and I commuted to London for a bit, and it was a real sort of, this is how it's going to be, you know. Could still be working, I could still be commuting, you know. But it was like, I'm going to spend, you know, I'm going to spend an hour and a quarter on the train each way every day. I do loads of reading. And by the end of it, I was just on my phone the whole time.
Right.
your ideals just get beaten down because that's what everyone else is doing. And, you know, it's just, it wasn't good. So then I was like, tired, yeah, I've got, what source of income? We need an income, you know. So what source of income? In my nice job I had, I did picture framing and things like that, wood workshop based sort of stuff. So I thought, well, I'll just start a little framing business, picture framing. Got a few contacts, and just sort of took it from there, really. And yeah, 5 years in, it's completely by accident, you know. But you know, we are adapting. We're living with less, you know. Thinking about picture framing again, it was a, you know, it was like more like, this is the only thing I can do, you know. Right. 4 years in art school, what can I do to make money? But from a kind of eco point of view, it sort of, you know, it ticks a few boxes. Obviously, you know, use timber, but you know, sort of managed sources, whatever that means. But you know, glass can be recycled. The board can be recycled. There's not a lot of waste, really, you know. So that kind of, I just tell myself that lie to justify it.
It's funny, though.
It's a form of consumption, isn't it? People are buying nice art and they're getting it framed. But my frames might last 25 years instead of two. Like the ones you buy in there, Home Depot or whatever, you know. So it's all, yeah, and I only work with wood because a lot of picture framing now is just kind of plastic.
Yeah, we've noticed that.
Coated things, yeah, and it's just gnarly. So anything you do with your hands is,
yeah.
If you're using your hands, then you're not looking at a screen, presumably.
Right.
So
that's exactly right.
That's a good start, isn't it? I think we've been quite lucky. I'm not trying to dish out advice about everything about adaptation or dropping out or anything, you know. But
right.
We make our own bread. We cook our own meals. You know, like these little things, they're just slightly taking you out of that kind of cycle of... I liked what you said about the toolbox, because I don't know who this is a quote from. Have you heard this? You can't take apart the master's house using his tool.
Yeah, totally.
That's good. Yeah.
That's good. So, that's good. That's good.
You can't use the master's tools. So this little sort of toolbox, I think you should do that. It should be like 12 rules dropping out. One, fuck the lawn. Yeah. Two, cook your own meals, you know, find out where your food comes from. Yeah, we get a veg box and it's all stuff grown in Cambridgeshire, and we can't grow our own vegetables. You know, we grow our own vegetables in the spring and the summer, and
okay,
the fall and winter. But yeah, and it's just, you know, like finding, because in some ways you don't want to sound like you live a joyless life. There's just so much. I don't know if it's just because we come from a sort of aesthetic background, but everything's just beautiful, you know. It's just, you know, I'm here now looking at my work dooryard and the sun setting over some birch trees.
Oh, nice.
It's just really painful, man. It's just like beautiful. And all that stuff, like growing your own food, it's just, you know, some family come round, you're like, you know, we grew that and we cooked it and now you can enjoy it. You know, it's like there's a real kind of generosity there in, you know, and just sort of taking everything back and a step back and having a...
To your point, adaptation and dropping out, it doesn't have to feel like sacrifice.
No.
It feels like the opposite.
Yeah, I think
of that.
To sort of summarize, you know, like I said, you know, like me and CJ, we sort of feel like we've always been, we dropped out when we were 18 because we didn't go for a career path. You know, CJ said her motivation was just to try and do what she liked or loved doing, you know.
Right.
And I think also once you stop participating in some of these things, then it's kind of hard. It's sort of irresistible in a way. Like the more sort of gardening, or the more you're out there, you know, in the woods or whatever it is you like doing it, you know, it becomes sort of addictive. And so the dropping out starts to become a bit of a sort of natural process. CJ, she said, it's not that you don't like capitalism, you just don't like spending money. And it's kind of, but then if you start to deconstruct that, it's like, well, is capitalism just based on spending money anyway? You know, that is the modus operandi.
Are you good at drawing, painting, sculpting, photography? What about woodworking, metalworking, printmaking? Are you able to perfectly replicate other pieces of art? Can you draw a circle? Do you like coloring? What about cartoons or video games? For those touched with a creative spark, you no longer have to worry about being scorned, ridiculed, and shamed by your family. Your parents won't fear that you'll wear black, smoke stuff, and have weird hair and piercings for the rest of your life. Because with your skill and our training, you'll be ready to work in advertising or as the chief aesthetics officer of a Fortune 500 company. With student loans, you'll be forced to work hard and ship, focusing your talents on the most productive art in the world. Visit thepriceforart.com today for a customized recommendation on the best school for you or a loved one. There are over 6,000 for-profit art schools, with half offering fully online courses, and they all offer 100% financing with no cosigner. Finally, you can sell your art if you make it like we tell you.
J.A., we really appreciate you, you know, coming on The Sinkhole and just briefly sharing your story. We're going to hear a lot more from J.A., including some upcoming episodes. And so just dipping a toe in the water here with our first adaptation story outside of, you know, KC and I just talking to ourselves in the backyard. And so, J.A., thanks, man. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you so much.
To finish up here, J.A., do you have a book recommendation that you want to give us and the listeners?
Yeah, but it's a bit niche. If you got any listeners in the
UK, we traffic in niche here.
Yeah.
There's a guy called Roger Deakin, D-E-A-K-I-N. I think he's one of the original founders of Friends of the Earth charity. But he wrote a book called Waterlog, and it was... He spent a year wild swimming in the UK, and it's just full of digressions and fascinating insights. He's a real cool dude. Unfortunately, he died quite young, but he's a, yeah. So Waterlog, Roger Deakin.
Well, thank you. Hey, one of many conversations, man. So you can't do it all in one conversation, but this is, you know, in terms of adaptation stories go, this was super cool. If you have an adaptation story out there that you want to share with us, we want to hear it. carbonsinkhole@protonmail.com. Thanks, J.A.
All right. Keep up the good work.
Thanks.
Appreciate it, man. Take care.
Bye.
I just got to be honest with you. I'm not one of them bullshit show business people, man. Who makes believe everything is going okay. You know? Because everything is not going okay, man.